Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. It's a home improvement day, and today we'll focus on a lot of things, but decks and outdoor living areas certainly on our minds as we visit with Chad Spate back with us, owner of Chad's Design Build. Chad, good to see you.
Thanks, Larry. Always great to be here.
And Tim Quigley back with us as well. Tim owns Quigley Decks and Quigley Cable Rail. And Tim, good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
As we talk with our guests, I hope you'll join in. Maybe you have questions about decks or deck materials. What would you like to know about constructing or maybe staining a deck? Maybe you have some other kind of home improvement question. Chad and Tim are here to help out. So give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email to talk@WPR.org. Chad, I'm sure you're busy. What kind of projects are you working on these days?
So we are busy. We're about a year out from, you know, phone call to initiating a project, and that's because we go through a careful planning process. The projects that we're currently doing, kitchens, bathrooms, a couple of additions. We build a fair number of screen porches. Lower level renovations.
So you're busy.
Yeah.
Tim, I'm sure you've been busy as well. What are some of the projects you're working on with consumers?
Yeah, Larry, we had a very busy summer. The majority of our projects are decks. Mm-hmm. Some of these projects will involve a patio as well on a lower level. And but that's something we usually bring in a landscaping, hardscape contractor for. And we, you know, decks, pergolas, shade, cable railing. And that's pretty much the majority of our business.
And we're seeing a lot of innovation in those outdoor products. Talk about some examples of that.
Yeah. A big thing now is, and what people are demanding, is slip-resistant deck boards. And there are a couple of companies that have brought that onto the market, and there's other products coming onto the market as well from other manufacturers. People are looking for lower maintenance decks. They want to build a deck and be done with it so they can enjoy it.
Yeah.
And, you know, a big thing, our cable railing is really doing well because people really like to be able to look out into their yards. A lot of our customers are gardeners and where they can see the fruits of their labor.
Yeah, it's all good things. And as you were talking, I was remembering my deck that I had in my lake home and staining that deck. I actually took the deck off and made a patio, a stone patio out of, instead, which eliminated all outside weather, efforts. But I think if I'd have done it today, I might have kept the deck if I'd known that I could find one that was really going to last and I wasn't going to have so much maintenance for it.
Yeah, the materials have come a long ways in the last 10 years. In the last 10 years, they've greatly improved. And just take a power hose, or not even a power hose, just a garden hose at the end of the year, and just wash it down. You might need to take a little deck brush and give it a light scrubbing, and you're good to go.
Chad, what are the trends you're seeing in your line?
So when we're building decks or porches on many of our projects, we're also having a high demand for the sort of rail that allows for visibility.
Yeah.
So we're moving away from wood rails, and cable rail is one option, but custom just metal rails, you know, with thin metal balusters, aluminum and stainless steel are the most popular materials. And while the railing itself is expensive to install, it's like the synthetic decking that's likely below it. Very little is going to be required in the way of maintenance over the years.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. We had the second floor bedroom in our home that looked out over the, and then there was another room, but it looked out over the lake, and we actually installed, instead of a we put a wire sort of railing in, pipe and wire railing, and it was really great to wake up in the morning and be able to actually see outside and see the lake.
Oh, yeah.
Guy in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Guy.
Hi. I hope this works. I'm interested in possibly putting on what I'd call a balcony deck versus a post-supported deck. So the deck itself would be supported by diagonal bracing. It's an inside corner. We just fill out the corner. So on the one side, there would have to be a bracket, a gusset, or whatever you call it. And I'm wondering what would be reasonable for the extension depth from the building to the outside railing. Can we go 5 feet, 6 feet?
Okay, so this is on second floor, Guy?
Second floor, yeah.
Yeah, okay, so you want to kind of be freestanding. Tim or Chad?
Yeah, well, so, I mean, it's really going to come down to how the house is built. And, you know, it is true that you are likely to be able to erect a balcony that is supported by diagonal bracketing, but there will have to be appropriate structural members in the wall to accommodate that bracket and that load. And that's part of planning for a project like the one you're envisioning. There's no, you know, there's certain rules for how far you can cantilever a deck beyond the typical post or beam or brace. But, you know, those, again, that all just plays into the design for what would be prudent and code compliant to give you a balcony that will last many years. So it would not be unusual for a balcony like that to be, say, 5 or maybe 6 feet deep. It will be helpful structurally that you have that inside corner to erect that balcony, because more would be required in the way of bracing. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't have but one connection point or one side that connects to the house. So.
Okay. Guy, does that help?
That's good. It gives us something to look for in terms of a potential that would have to be verified.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Tim, you wanted to add something, too?
Yeah, I would start off by bringing in an engineer or an architect to do an analysis of that area of the house, and they will definitely help you get going off on the right foot in the right direction.
Yeah,
that'd be my first step.
Makes a lot of sense. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Thinking back to a program we did a couple of weeks back on falls, and we kind of lead the nation in falls. And how do you? And on that note, how can you make your deck as safe as possible?
I'd start with the railings. Make sure you have good solid railings on, especially on the stairs. I wasn't listening to your show the last time, but the railings are where on the stairs, whether it's inside or outside the house, is where the most falls happen.
Yeah, I've seen people want to lean against them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I've seen some pretty rickety ones that would not be good to be leaning against.
Well, the secret with the railing is it's only as strong as the structure underneath that's supporting it.
Yeah.
So you want to make sure you got a good solid structure underneath. And also, if you're building a new deck, look into the slip-resistant materials. And if you have an existing deck, just check it for maybe refinishing it or something like that might help with a slip-resistant paint stain.
Could be helpful as well. Yeah. Kay in Three Lakes has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Kay.
Hello. We're building a house that's going to have a walkout deck on a flat roof, and we're looking for a water, a water permanent resistant material that we can actually walk on that's appropriate for a flat roof.
Were you looking for a water resistance that acts as the surface of the deck, or were you going to put down decking boards on it and looking for the waterproofing underneath?
We wanted to avoid putting down decking boards if we could, because here in the North Woods, we'll fight pine needles all the time.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. What I would do is I would look at roofers in your area. There is a product, and the name escapes me right now. Maybe you know it, Chad, but it's usually installed by roofers. They're set up to do that.
Yeah, there are some PVC products or PVC-laden products that can be applied to the typical residential deck, and there are some commercial grades of this product as well that would allow you to have a walkable, reasonably puncture-resistant surface. You can have tables and chairs on it. And then there are a variety of products that can rest directly on a flat roof. There are some recycled rubber products. There are, I will say that some of those pads that can be put down, I've recently read some articles about some of the contaminants that are in those products, and certainly as it relates to playground surfaces. So I'm a little more skeptical of that product at the moment, but there are things that can be put on top of a flat roof short of building a floating deck that also allow you to easily access the roof if you find that there isn't a good solution for just a roof that you are given by some of the roofers you talk to. But there are some options out there.
Yeah. All right. Kay, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Brad from Minnesota emailed us. About 5 years ago, they added an addition to their home, which included a deck. They really wanted the horizontal cable for the deck railing and sides. However, their contractor absolutely refused, as it was against Minnesota code, as the code excludes anything that would entice climbing by a child. Does Wisconsin code have precautions against the horizontal railing? After hearing that, they totally agreed with the code and have warned neighbors who have children and wanted this kind of railing.
Good question. Cable railing is allowed in the state of Wisconsin. And we installed a cable railing for a couple in the Fox River Valley area with grandkids. And she said they won't climb it. There's also research out there that if children can see past the railing, the instinct is not there to climb it. I don't know how true that is. In Canada, cable railing was not allowed for a long time, and it was just about 3 years ago they allowed it due to research that they had. And but yet at the same time, I would say, if you're whatever kind of a railing you want to install on your deck, if it's something that makes you feel unsafe, or makes your children feel unsafe, then it's probably not a good fit for you.
Yeah, that makes really, really good sense. Brad from Minnesota, thank you for that email. You can join in too. You can email us to talk@wpr.org, or just pick up the phone and give a call. 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Talking with Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build and Tim Quigley, owner of Quigley Decks and Quigley Cable Rail. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along on this Home Improvement Day for WPR News as we visit with Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build and Tim Quigley of Quigley Decks and Quigley Cable Rail. We've talked about decks and so forth for a bit, and certainly we can talk more about them, and I hope you'll join in with your deck questions. But you can also call in with another home improvement question that you might have. Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. And Chad, you wanted to bring something up relating to an earlier call.
Yeah, Kay from Three Lakes had called in and asked about products to put on a flat roof that are adequate for walking and patio furniture. And Deck Tech is a product that we have used successfully on a number of projects. The name was not right at the tip of my tongue when we were talking, but I thought of it just as we went off air. So.
Deck Tech.
Correct.
Okay, there we go. Mac emailed us. Their small home doesn't have an entry area. They're considering adding a small entryway with the current garage or within the current garage. Mac probably has space for a 4.5-foot projection into the garage. And they moved the entry door to the new outside wall and replaced the current entry door with an open passage. Mac would add a closet and bench. General planning advice? Almost need to have him on the line to explain it more fully.
Well, yes, and then, of course, a picture's worth a thousand words. Yeah. So, you know, there are many things to consider. We have examples of projects similar to what is being described where we've been able to create somewhat of a mudroom or just a, you know, area to make it easier to come into the home from a garage. It is potentially possible. The things you have to think about are that typically the flat surface, the concrete floor of the garage is on top of the footing ledge that should be under the home if it has typical foundation walls. Typically, you cannot just create a point load onto that floor with some sort of protrusion addition into it. So typically, we're going to be putting in a typical pier footing at the location there beneath it. And then, of course, you've got to think about getting around in the garage, spatial planning. You don't want to make it so that it's hard to get in and out of your car to get to that door. So perhaps Mac has figured, you know, has considered all of these things. But those are the sorts of things that we would be talking about. And no matter what you're thinking about doing, certainly we always encourage our clients to get some masking tape and you know, mark out the space and kind of try to live with it. And yeah. You know,
thinking about driving into the garage, and if it's the steps are on the end, then you drive the car in, and then you got to go around one way or the other of the car to get sort of around then to get up the steps.
Right. I mean, it all comes down to how large that garage actually is and whether or not it's going to be a practical, useful solution. You know, sometimes things are code compliant or possible, but they don't end up necessarily serving the goal, you know, the functional goal. And so we try very hard to make sure that the solutions are going to be useful and people are going to be happy they did it.
Yeah. I was thinking about my two-car garage. If I had something like that in my two-car garage, I'd want to park my car on the right side so that I could get out and just go on the steps in my daughter Emily's car. She would have to get out and go around.
Sure. Well, and I can give an example of a client we're currently working with to plan a potential ramp in their garage, and they are they're doing things to make their home more accessible as they get older and safe, and they're down to being a one-car family. So they have a two-car garage that is going to have only one vehicle in it, and that allows them to do some things that are semi-permanent to make their home as safe and functional as it can be for their purposes. And at the same time, you know, we're going to be thinking about, can this be easily undone for a future buyer? Do they care? Yeah. You know, these are the sorts of questions we engage our clients with. So.
Dennis in Two Rivers emailed us about 2005. His parents had a wooden deck installed, and by 2015, after he inherited the house, some porch boards were rotting, and kind of fixed those, paid for sanding and new sealer. The porch is north facing, was shaded by spruce trees. Wondering, what's the typical life of treated wood, Tim?
Yeah, the quick answer to that is depending on where the wood came from. If it's a reputable mill, you know, you'll get 15 to 20 years out of it. I've seen some treated wood lasting as little as 5 years. But then it all depends on, you know, whether there's a shaded area, sunshine, because the sun... as long as the area can dry out pretty fast, it greatly extends the life of the wood itself. It's not really a direct answer, but it comes to the area of the house where it is, and he mentioned trees.
Yeah. Yeah, it was an old cedar deck, but he did mention cedar trees too, I think, in the conversation.
Oh, can I add to that, Larry? If it is cedar, it's important that it can dry out pretty quick, because when cedar is constantly wet, it's and especially if the deck is low to the ground, it can rot out before its time.
Sharon in Madison emailed us, is there a reason why most staircases aren't less steep? Since Sharon already has a deck with a steep staircase, how expensive or troublesome is it to have that redone, having the staircase at least less steep slant than usual? Does seem more relaxing to go down, and it seems a lot safer to her.
Great question, and it's a problem we run into quite a lot. The standard depth of a step that we have is 10.5 inches, and that's pretty average. If you, instead of going with a 7.75 inch rise, that would be the height from one thread to the next, they could go make it a little lower, like a 6, 6.5. That, of course, will extend it out a little bit and is less, feels less intimidating to walk up and down.
Yeah, it's going to extend it out, what? It won't double it, but it'll...
Yeah. And you can make the treads a little wider as well. Our standard is 10.5 inches. People have requested wider ones. We've done 15-inch treads for that reason.
Yeah. Chad, anything to add?
Yeah, so, I mean, to specifically for the question, one of the limitations that often explains a steeper stairs is that the zoning might not allow the stair to protrude further in a particular direction, and therefore we end up designing the stairway to be as space efficient as possible. And it's also true that there's less material in a steeper stairs, and so it's often a more a less costly stairway.
Yeah.
The ancient Greeks figured out how a stair should be built. I mean, there's a simple formula for calculating the relationship between the rise, which is the height of the step, and the run, which is the depth. And it's basically the run plus 2 times the rise equals 25 inches, or 25. And so you know, that dictates if you want to create a comfortable stairway. You know, if any of our listeners ever come to the Capitol building here in Madison, those steps are very deep and the rise of each step is very shallow, but it conforms with that formula from the classical Greeks. And so anyway, that's a little bit of a diversion,
that's something
perhaps,
I'm going to think about the next time I'm at the Capitol. that's pretty cool. Tim, you were going to add something there?
No, we're good, I think.
Okay. Oh, man. Well, this whole business of shade and porches, we were talking about shade as having an effect on the deck, but shade for porches, how are people adding shade to their backyard?
There's, of course, the traditional pergola, and now there's companies manufacturing fill-in spaces for these pergolas, and retractable awnings, but retractable, the name escapes me right now, louvers for the that goes down between the joists and the pergola. What's getting popular now are shade sails.
So they look like sails.
Yeah, and they're so instead of going up and down, they're going across, maybe in towards the house. The only thing with them, you have to take them down in the winter, which is not I wouldn't think a big deal.
Yeah, it shouldn't be too much of a deal. What is that? What you would consider an outdoor room? I know there are outdoor rooms that are getting some popularity.
Two-season porches or three-season porches, and then like a patio that's covered over completely with a pergola.
Now, I sure like my front deck. I was sitting out on that front deck, which I've been doing most every night for dinner, and it's a nice thing to have for sure. Outdoor kitchens, speaking of food, outdoor kitchens, what about them? How popular are they?
They're getting more popular. Right now, they can be a little bit price prohibitive, but they are getting popular. The days of your Weber grill, I think, now are pretty much numbered. I shouldn't say numbered, but you know, there's outdoor refrigeration, outdoor stoves. We could go on and on.
Yeah, I would say that part of the reason that the outdoor kitchens are not as big of a deal in the Wisconsin market as they are, say, in Arizona or Florida, is just that we have seasons where we're not going to be outside using that space. And so, as Tim said, they're not cheap to really do a permanent, nice, particular. I mean, I've seen these high-end outdoor kitchens when I've been in those other states, but I don't often see them or talk about them here in Wisconsin. So I think the Weber grills will be around, but there, if someone really wants to have that really nice outdoor space, they can certainly do it. There are appliances that are made specifically to withstand the fluctuations in temperature. You would not put a typical appliance designed for a kitchen that's interior out on a exterior patio, because often those kitchens are fully exposed to the elements.
Yeah, Tim.
And what's getting popular now are the pellet grills, more of the high-end wood-burning grills, and I keep an eye out because you're going to see pizza ovens coming on the market. There's people already talking to me about them. I talked to one client a couple of weeks ago, and they have a pizza oven that they want to have a space on their deck for.
So in the vein of a fired-type oven?
There's both available. There's the wood-burning pizza ovens, and then there's the propane.
Yeah. Could you get a natural gas? What I did.
You probably could.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, because grills are often available.
I've got a pretty large Weber, and I And there was an insert, sort of, there was a spot, a corner of the backyard, of the house in the backyard where it just fit in perfectly. So I, rather than worry about gas tanks or LP gas, I just had the folks install the line, and it's got natural gas for that. And a couple of other Weber grills for with barbecue and a picnic table. That's kind of my outdoor kitchen, to be perfectly honest.
And I think, I'm not going to speak for all propane grills, but most of them can be converted to natural gas. It's just a matter of changing out some mechanics on the inside of it.
Yeah, I think you can. I started that way. I just thought, you know, why not? Just have it right next to the house, and it works really, really well for me. Talking home repair and renovation today, we've been looking at decks but and outdoor cooking areas and outdoor rooms with our guests, but we'll take other home improvement questions as well. What's on your mind? What do you got in mind for your house? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. If you live in town, as I do, you might not get a lot of privacy in your backyard, and some homeowners associations might ban fences in a backyard. How could you use a deck or other outdoor features to create a private backyard? That looks good.
First, I guess evergreens, mm-hmm. evergreen trees, arborvitaes, things like that, and privacy panels on the deck or an area next to the deck or the patio, like semi-transparent privacy panels do a really nice job on that.
That makes sense.
We've built some decks. For example, we've had some clients over the years that are building a deck specifically to have a hot tub out there. Mm-hmm. And they want to have privacy around that tub. And, you know, we'll put a 6-foot tall privacy fence, mm-hmm. you know, designed to their liking around that part of the deck. And so that becomes the de facto rail, but you can't see through it. Or it's very limited, you know. You have there might be some slats where, from the right angle, you get a glimpse. Yeah. But there are a lot of options to address that. But I like Tim's suggestion. I mean, often landscaping is a way to address some of those HOA rules.
Cheryl in Berlin has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. I would like to know what your guest thinks of composite decking.
Composite decking. Tim, well, what do you think?
Yeah.
Start with you.
There's a lot of good products out there, and then there's, like everything else, there's some not-so-good products out there. I would look at the manufacturers, what you want from the composite decking. Do you want something that's slip-resistant? Do you want something that's going to hold up against hot sun? There's two composites that are on the market right now, and we've had a lot of success with them. One is a full PVC, a recycled PVC composite decking board, and the other is, they call it a mineral-based. It doesn't have any wood particles or anything like that on it. The composite decking boards with the sawdust and the wood particles, if they are not protected from the elements, if they're able to absorb water, then you might have trouble with that down the road, difficulty with it. And so right now the ones we're having the most success with are the ones that don't have the wood particles in them.
Okay. Chad?
Yeah, I would agree with everything that Tim just said. You know, the other thing that we always weigh when we're helping a client decide what's right for them is how long has this particular product or company been around, and what's their track record been with synthetic decking. So, for example, Trex was one of the early adopters to the composite world, and they still make an excellent product. But that product has changed a lot over the years. There were some issues with their earlier products. They helped resolve those warranty claims. You know, I know this because we installed some of their product, which ended up having some issues, and we helped our clients resolve those issues. But if something seems really inexpensive or too good to be true, then it probably is.
Yeah. Is there a manufacturer, Tim, on the ones that the two that you mentioned that you use?
The two that we use, our two go-to, are Decorators and AZAC TimberTech.
AZAC what?
AZAC, well, it's owned by a company called TimberTech, but the PVC okay, product is AZAC.
AZAC, okay. Cheryl, does that help?
Yes, very much.
All right, thanks very much for calling. And again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Larry Mueller here with my guests, Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build and Tim Quigley, owner of Quigley Decks and Quigley Cable Rail. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News as we talk home renovation and repair with Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build and Tim Quigley of Quigley Decks and Quigley Cable Rail. Great to have them along. Questions could be about decks, could be about anything else relating to home renovation. We'd love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Mary in Wisconsin Rapids next. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. My husband and I have been building an outdoor deck out of block, an outdoor kitchen. My question is we're anticipating putting a retractable shade over top of the kitchen area. Do you guys have any experience with that or have any handy hints?
Sure. Tim, we'll start with you.
Yeah. First of all, I would look into the manufacturer. Is this something you're doing yourself, Mary, or are you hiring a contractor to do it?
My husband's a concrete contractor, so he's been doing all the work.
Okay. So he'd be familiar with these products. Look into the manufacturer. And look at their warranties, things like that. Also, I would look at where the awning is going to be attached to the house. That would be very important because if a wind comes up, you don't want that awning going across to your neighbor's yard like a coyote or anything like that. There are retractable awnings. Some have wind sensors on them, so when the wind picks up, it will automatically go back in. That's a nice feature to have. And others, then they don't have that feature. But just make sure you roll that back in if you're leaving or anything like that. That's
good advice, Chad.
Yeah, all I was going to add is that while we have not had many retractable awning projects, I have probably looked at more homes that used to have a retractable awning, and we are going to be upgrading the wall or the roof area where this awning wants to be reattached, because as Tim just alluded to, like, you have got to have a proper structure that is more than likely going to need to be reinforced to accommodate the load, not just of the structure, but the wind that Tim alluded to, that then is going to put a tremendous load on your home wherever it's attached. And I wanted to just add, there's at least one company in the Madison area that we have seen install temporary awnings, but they put in a permanent structure. It's often an aluminum framework. And then the awnings can be removed for the winter. But, you know, that's another way to go, maybe a little bit less, graceful or minimalist. Certainly that retractable awning is a great idea.
Yeah.
But you've got to have the structure to accommodate it. And an awning that is lightweight enough and strong enough to be a long-lasting awning is going to be an expensive awning. So
yeah, and add in the wind, one that recognizes wind. I think that would add a little bit to the cost of it as well.
Yeah, but it's
Worth it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's worth it, Mary. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Lee called but couldn't hang on, but is wondering what's a good high-quality liquid finish for cedar floorboards on a deck that has an overhang?
A good question. Cabot's is one of them. For that, I would consult a painting store like Sherwin-Williams, or I always like to go to Premier Paints in McFarland.
Mm-hmm.
Phil is just an encyclopedia of knowledge when it comes to those sort of things.
Yeah, but Cabot's you mentioned?
Cabot's is one of them.
Okay.
And there's another one, too, that the name Penafin is another one.
Penafin, yeah. Okay. And you've had some luck with that, too, Chad? Or?
Correct. And then I would just add that, you know, typically, cedar decking is going to want to be refinished every 2 to 3 years. I mean, it does depend on the exposure to the sun, the overall design, how much snow is hanging out on it, and whether it gets to dry out year-round. These are all factors, and the sort of detritus that falls out of the trees. But, yeah.
Brandy from Lake Mills emailed us, please give your opinions about if it's practical to make a rooftop deck. If so, what suggestions and materials are recommended for safety and longevity? Are these allowed in the city? Well, the Brandy's from Lake Mills, but so we may not know exactly about that.
In most cases, they will be allowed.
Mm-hmm.
It will have to meet the building code if it's an existing, if he's putting a deck on an existing roof. He would need to get an architect or an engineer involved in order to be able to get a permit to do that. But in as I said, in most cases, they are allowed.
Yeah, structural engineer.
Yeah.
Yeah, to go in and look at it. So, and the materials for safety and longevity?
So if they've already got a flat roof, and typically that's going to be a rubber roof, that if that's in excellent shape and it's maybe less than 5 years old, they might consider having a floating deck on that. And again, all the engineering and code compliance has to be looked into, but there are ways to put some sort of a floating deck over that. It can be wood, but the biggest challenge with a wood floating deck on top of a EPDM roof is that, you know, there's the potential to puncture that roof. So a lot of steps need to be taken to allow that to work. And often when we do it, we're putting in panels that can be removed, so that decking panels, so that you can regain access to that roof and clean it and make sure, you know, inspect it.
So that's why it would be a floating deck. Somebody already wants to know what's a floating deck.
Yeah, well, so a floating deck is one where the attachments are not being made through the roof. It's attaching out often to the railing structure. The railing almost inevitably is going to be affixed to the roof, and then typically there's going to be one or two or sometimes three walls that you are abutting when you're putting in this sort of a deck. But then you want to minimize penetrating a roof.
Yeah.
And when you do penetrate a roof, you have to go through a proper process where you're, you know, sealing it so that you're not going to then have leaks where that attaches. And so we call it a floating deck because the the points of penetration are often minimalized, and then it's just resting there, a combination of proper design and inertia and gravity keep that thing there. And obviously it can't just literally be completely unattached, because it could go, you know, airborne in a windstorm. But it's called floating because it's not attached as much as a structure where you're typically, you know, making all these attachments.
All right. That makes sense to me. I have a deck that is rubber, and it's been in for 12 years on the second floor, and seems to be okay, but I still worry about it. You wonder, when is it, you know, how long is it going to really last?
Yeah, I mean, and you know, a rubber roof is a lot like a deck itself as far as how long it's going to last, because it has to do with what's falling on it, whether or not it's drying out, how much snow is sitting on it. What we see is that the average life of a properly installed rubber roof is about 20 years. Now, they can start to fail around 10 years, and that wouldn't necessarily be a sign that anything was done wrong. It's just that sometimes the conditions of the home, and more importantly, the orientation of that structure to the elements, contribute to a faster aging, and they have to be replaced.
I had to, this is a sort of along the same lines, but I have a three-story house, and on the third story, when we remodeled that and made it a bedroom, we had to put in a light in the roof, in order to have enough window space. There's a certain number of square feet that you have to have.
Of natural light. Yes.
And I've wondered about that for the last 12 years as to when that might start to break up itself.
Sure, like it's a skylight or a solid tube.
The word I was trying to come up with, and couldn't come up with it.
Well, and there again, you know, skylights. I mean, I've been doing this for 33 years, so... You know, I'm at the point where, a client from 30 years ago will call us up and say, you know, that skylight you put in for us, or maybe it was, 20 years ago. I would expect a skylight to last 20 to 30 years. We've had some that now need to be replaced because it's been 20 or 30 years. And it's like anything else in the home. You want to be keeping an eye on the potential for water intrusion. And talking about skylights, I mean, sometimes it's simply condensation that's happening on the skylight, particularly if it's a skylight in a bathroom. You would expect to see some condensation when you're taking long showers, and just depending on the time of year and the difference between the interior air conditions and what's going on outside. When skylights start to fail, it's important to act on that.
And quickly.
Yeah, because you really don't, that when water's getting into a home, be it through the roof or rotting boards or a skylight or window, you can do some temporary patching to allow the planning for a more thorough, complete fix. But if you've, done a few roof patches and your roof is 20 plus years old, you got to plan for that roof replacement, because at some point the Band-Aids aren't going to work anymore.
Makes a lot of sense to me. We're talking home renovation and repair today with Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build and Tim Quigley of Quigley Decks and Quigley Cable Rail. Questions for them, you can join in 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. We are going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on WPR, and then we'll be back with our guests. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller. Taking a look at home improvement on the show today, how you can make the best use of your outdoor living space, or if you have a project that you want to have done within the house, maybe you have a question in that area, please feel free to join in. Our guest, Chad Spate of Chad's Design Build, and Tim Quigley of Quigley Decks and Quigley Cable Rail. Still time for your questions. You can join in at 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Sue emailed us. She wants to put steel siding on her house, which is currently covered with cedar siding, which woodpeckers are eating, more or less. Her house is 42 years old, and Sue's Pella windows seem good, but should she replace them before she puts the new siding on?
Great question, Sue. A couple of things. One is a general rule. If you are wanting to or needing to upgrade both your siding and your windows, there will never be a better time to do it than at the same time. And specifically, the windows would be installed or replaced first. And then there is a integrated rain plane of some sorts. Many people are familiar with Tyvek, or if they have an older home, they know there's tar paper underneath their siding. And whatever it is, any structure requires some sort of material that is designed to keep the liquid water from getting in once it gets past whatever the cladding is on the house. It could be wood siding, it could be steel siding, it could be masonry. Any of that requires some sort of protective water cover behind it. So the siding company that might install new siding on your home should be doing something to restore that water plane prior to putting up the siding, and the windows would be integrated best into that rain plane or water plane. The issue of woodpeckers, I mean, typically when woodpeckers are going after cedar siding, there are, you know, there's some rot and there's some bugs or something that are getting into those damaged areas, and the woodpeckers really like the slightly deteriorated or softened wood. They don't have to, I mean, woodpeckers will occasionally peck away at something just for fun, but, you know, that can be part of the explanation. So there could be some other things going on when this old siding is removed that should be addressed as part of upgrading.
I was thinking about insulation, because it might be a time if you needed to have insulation.
Right. It would certainly be a bad idea to have a home performance evaluation done. I mean, that's a great Wisconsin program that you can have your house kind of thoroughly assessed for how airtight it is, and some thermal imaging is done to see if there are areas that need that lack the proper insulation. And you're right, Larry, that's a great point. You'd want to do that when the siding is being replaced. You know, as far as whether, I don't know if Sue is asking about whether steel siding is the right answer. I mean,
I think she wants to put it on, but what's the benefit or advantage of it?
Well, it is an option. I don't, I'm somewhat agnostic as far as what the best option is. I mean, you know, it really comes down to what you want. I would encourage our listeners to do a little research beyond my answer on the pros and cons of different siding materials. There are publications like Fine Home Building or This Old House, which have some great articles talking about different types of siding and what are the pros and cons of them. I mean, typically we talk about steel or aluminum siding, you know, being very long lasting. They can be repainted if you get tired of the color or they get kind of scuffed up. The downside is that they can dent. You know, so if a rock comes flying out of your lawnmower or a baseball doesn't get caught and it hits your home, you know, there's going to be a dent in it if you have metal siding. But if you have vinyl siding, it'll probably get broken. I would say that vinyl siding is my least favorite siding because it's very polluting to produce, but it is the least expensive siding, so it is kind of the default siding. In the industry. I'm a big fan of smart siding, but that's a composite wood pulp siding. It's essentially taking waste from the lumber making process and turning it into a product with resins that is very durable. It gets painted. It's got a great warranty, but it too can eventually fail. That would be... I think I've addressed the myriad of potential concerns.
Yeah, and Tim, it's not steel siding, but you do use steel framing, I think, exclusively, do you not? And we'll talk about why that's the case.
We use steel framing pretty much exclusively, but not in all situations. The decking boards that we use, the ones that I mentioned earlier, they're coming with a minimum of 25-year warranty. And so does it mix? And then... a lot of the lumber, after about 15, 20 years, that starts to fail. So that's the reason we use the steel frame, the understructure for the deck itself.
Well, that absolutely makes sense to me. And somebody else is wondering about curb appeal. What are your thoughts? What is, apparently somebody is maybe selling the house or thinking about it, what do either of you consider to be the best curb appeal projects to be when it comes time to maybe sell a house?
Like first impressions when people walk
up?
Well, the rule of thumb, I guess, is the front door. Then if you have a railing, if you have a small deck or a porch or something in the front of the house and the railing looks kind of dilapidated, that would be a good step.
Yeah.
And, you know, then the condition of the siding, obviously. I mean, if you need a fresh coat of paint or if there's some repairs that need to be done, certainly take care of it.
I always said I would, if I was going to sell my house, I would sell it in mid-July. I'd put it on the market because I've had this great flowers array that really is at its peak at around July 15th or somewhere in there. And so flowers and that sort of thing can make a big difference too.
Right. No, that's true.
Probably never sell my house, but... at least I don't plan to. But anyway, those are some tips on that. How should you approach talking with a professional about having a deck built or designed? What's the process you go through with a client, Tim?
Yeah, when they reach out to us, you know, they contact us. Most of them contact us now through our website, and we will ask them to send us some photos of what they have there currently, and also, if possible, some photos of products that they like. That's kind of the personal relationship part between the homeowner and the contractor. Then, are they licensed? Do they have liability insurance, compensation insurance? All these little things are, you know, very important. Things sometimes are overlooked, but very important.
Are there professional associations connected with your line of work?
Yeah. We are a member of NARI, the National Association of the Remodeling Industry, and also NADRA, the National Deck and Railing Association. And, you know, they have standards that we have to adhere to.
Yeah. And you're in that kind of that same... circumstance being in terms of membership, you're a member of NARI as well, are you not?
Correct. And you know, Better Business Bureau and Remodelers Advantage, which is a professional roundtable group, but a lot of education and training associated there. And I would add, too, to as far as, you know, what a homeowner should be expecting, I think similar to what Tim said, you know, when someone reaches out to us, we're going to ask similar questions. We're going to let them know what any project, be it a deck or a kitchen or an addition, you know, what that might end up costing, the range of cost, and talk about, you know, whether or not our typical kind of experience is meeting with their expectation. And then if they're serious about it, we go through a planning and design phase, which is the first contractual step.
Okay.
So we're going to provide the engineering and the design, figure out what needs to happen based on the home, what they really want based on the myriad of options that are out there. And then, of course, figuring out what that's going to cost and deciding if that all works for them. So.
So, and they probably have an idea in mind of what it's, their costs are going to be or what they can afford to begin with.
Right. And that's always a question we ask, you know, what do you have a budget for this project? And, you know, if that budget isn't realistic, we talk about, well, you know, would you consider something less than what you thought you wanted or, you know.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Let's turn to Bruce in La Crosse next. Hi, Bruce.
Hey, good afternoon. I installed a deck on my brand-new house in 1993. I built both of them. And in 2011 or 2012, we had the tornado had gone through. It not only speared my hot tub, but it did a pretty bad job on the deck. I tore it off, and I had a local contractor that I know install a poured concrete stamped and dyed concrete patio, and I'll tell you what, it's the best.
That's not going to get blown away. Thanks, Bruce.
Thanks, Bruce.
I love that. I love that. Bruce took care of his business after that tornado. What should we be doing right now at the end of summer to sort of, prep the deck or the patio for winter? Is there anything we should be doing?
Yeah, with if it's a wood deck and it needs staining, it needs waterproofing, this is probably a good time to do it. Also, if the underneath of the deck is close to the ground, winter is a time where a lot of the critters start looking for a home. So it might be good to make sure that that's critter-proof, like from coyotes, foxes. And the stories I hear about foxes living underneath decks is quite common.
Even in Madison.
Yeah, even in Madison. So if it's a place where, you know, raccoons, foxes, anything like that would
groundhogs.
Like to set up residence. It might be a good idea to make sure that that's critter proof.
Yeah. One summer I actually trapped 10 groundhogs that were, wow. Had, that was that original deck that I was talking about. Oh my gosh, which also, all that problem went away when I went with a stone setup. Jim in Boston emailed us, in the process of replacing a 14-foot by 30-foot deck, there's three different levels that include steps between main and ground level. Wondering about composite or treated wood pricing. So this, they're replacing the whole thing, 14 by 30. If lights, solar, or electrical, it's a 60-year-old home, and they probably will stay in it for another 10 years or maybe less. So it's kind of composite or treated wood pricing on it, lights, solar, or electrical.
Yeah, it's... Did he say if he was planning on leaving the structure or taking down the structure?
He's replacing, so that's replacing. Getting rid of the old one.
Okay. That's a good question, because if you're planning on living there for 10 years, the composites are going to run more than the wood and the treated. You know, are you going to get your value back out of it? And also, another side to going with wood is, if you're selling it in 10 years, do you want to have a house? Do you want to have a deck on the house that looks like the wood needs replacing?
Yeah.
So it's a difficult, a difficult one, really.
What about he's talked about lighting, solar or electrical?
Lighting is getting very popular now, especially on stairs, on the steps. It's a nice way to light up the stairway without the feeling of having floodlights in your backyard. And also, lighting on the railing is just wonderful for ambience. It just makes you want to stay out there longer. And whether you want to go solar or electrical, that's really, it's up to the individual, really. The solar, it's, you kind of set it and forget it. There are solar panels that go on top of the posts that will charge your battery during the day, and they operate the bulbs. And you can also get a large solar panel to supply the whole lighting system. And but then there's the low voltage transformers that you plug into an outlet, and they are, you can operate them from your cell phone. You can from your smartphone. You can operate them from home, or operate them from, you know, you're on vacation or somewhere you want to turn on the lights at nighttime, or have it set automatically to come on at a certain time. The possibilities with that is just endless.
Endless, yeah. Any comments from you there, Chad?
No, I mean, I would agree with all that. And, of course, you know, it's so hard to talk about what something costs. But, you know, that is something that once we see a place and know really what someone wants, you can then start to create some reasonable expectations. But all those things, of course, do add.
Yeah. On the other hand, if you're going to be living in it for 10 years and using it for 10 years, I'd kind of want to have something that was, you know, in terms of the flooring, that I'm not going to slip and fall on, and that it's going to be a good quality material that will still be in good quality. And I, in the meantime, I've sat there for 10 years and enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, there's a story I always like to tell, Larry, that we had a client that about, I would say, 16, 17 years ago, we built a deck for that we put a synthetic decking on. And he called me up 11 years after we had built it and said, you know, Chad, I think there is rot. I think my deck boards are rotting. And I said, really? Well, okay. Well, I better come out and take a look at this. And what it was just moss that was growing on the detritus that was in the grooves of the faux wood on the deck boards. And I said, you know what? We can do a good cleaning of this deck, and I bet it's going to look good as new. And sure enough, that 11-year-old deck was in excellent condition. It just needed to be cleaned a little more frequently.
So that's probably not a bad thing to do as we get into... You know, if you're getting the deck ready for the winters, I think it's kind of good to go into the winter with a clean-looking deck and something that's going to, you know, not be all crummy in the spring.
Sure, sure.
And also, may I add to the person that's looking at selling the, building the deck and selling it in 10 years, like Chad said earlier, you need to restain the wood, repaint it every 2 to 3 years.
Yeah.
How much is that going to cost over the next 10 years?
Yeah, that's that's another way to look at it for sure. I can't. You're never going to find me painting a deck. Anyway, one that I own.
Right.
Because
right.
I do not want to go through that again. It's not worth the pain and frustration of having to, for me anyway. I'd rather have something that's going to I'm not going to have to deal with.
Yeah, but it's a choice. And, you know, I mean, some clients want to make that choice, and that's fine. You know, we want to educate them on what they're signing up for. And, we are a big fan of using wood just for its, you know, basic sustainability. So I don't want to not mention that, but there is a trade-off. And it's just a matter of knowing.
So if somebody wanted to talk to you, Tim, about is there still time in you know, your time frame to work on decks or outdoor kitchens or anything else?
Yeah, we can still fit in. We still have some openings for some projects this year. Now, there are people already planning for next year.
Oh, yeah.
And because we have a short outdoor season here, so the minute the sun starts to shine in the middle of April, people want to be out on their deck.
Yeah, absolutely. And they want to stay out there as long as they can on the other end of it as well. And Chad, you're looking about a year out, but you're talking to people all the time, I'm assuming.
That's right. And we go through a process. We've got about a 3-month backlog for our planning right now. And then that planning is typically 2 to 3 months. And then when someone says, yes, this thing that we've finalized together is what I want to do, then we're going to be putting it on the calendar 4 to 6 months out. And then you add all that together, and it's about a year from starting.
Yeah.
And also, Larry, there's this misconception or a myth in Wisconsin that you can't build decks in the winter. That's not true anymore. With the new footings that we have.
You can do it whenever.
You can build decks all year round.
Oh, all right. Something else I hadn't thought much about. I always just assumed like it's spring to late fall and that's it, but you can do it year round.
Yeah, as long as we can get the footings in the ground. That's all that matters.
Well, I tell you what, it's been fun talking with both of you. Thank you both so much for taking time to be with us today, and we'll look forward to another visit down the road.
Thanks, Larry.
Thank you, Larry.
Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build, one of our guests today. And by way of disclosure, we should mention that Chad's Design Build is one of WPR's many business sponsors. Tim Quigley, our guest as well. Tim is owner of Quigley Decks and Quigley Cable Rail. Coming up, we're going to turn our attention to, Wisconsin's a water lover's paradise, isn't it? And a lot of folks have homes and so, or second homes on lakes and rivers, and there's other folks who don't but are still interested in making sure those lakes and rivers are as clean as they can be. And we're going to be talking about that next with our guests. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Wisconsin is a water lover's paradise, as I mentioned. And after all, our state is really derived from an Algonquin word, honoring water. We have thousands of lakes, streams, and rivers. I wonder how many thousands of miles of lakeshore we have, and you add in the rivers. It's got to be, maybe our guests will know. We'll find out as we talk with them, because we want to visit about taking care of our private shorelines and what you can do to help your local lake. With us, Lori Hayden. Lori is the Watershed Protection Coordinator for the Wisconsin DNR's Water Quality Program. She's part of the Wonderful Waters of Wisconsin initiative. And Lauren also provides support and coordination for the Healthy Lakes and Rivers team. Lauren, welcome to the show.
Hi, Larry. Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you with us. Appreciate it very much. Eric Olson is Director of Extension Lakes at UW Stevens Point. And Eric, good to see you. Thanks for joining in.
You bet. Thanks, Larry.
As we talk with our experts, I hope you'll join in. You live near or on a river or a lake or maybe a pond. How important are the state's rivers and lakes to your quality of life? Maybe you could tell us what you're doing right now to improve the health of your shoreline, or maybe you have a question about how you could do a better job of improving the health. Give a call. The number, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Do we have any idea of how many miles of shoreline we have in the state of Wisconsin?
Larry, I do. If you include the Great Lakes, which is a good chunk of it, we're looking at about 13,000 miles or 68 million feet of shoreline in Wisconsin.
Oh, my. Well, you know, just in general, what's the status of shoreland in Wisconsin? I'm sure it varies lake to lake and stream to stream and everything else, but are the shores in good shape?
Well, I think of that shoreline, you know, there's really a mix. There's a lot of it is actually public land. We're fortunate. If you go up north, there's lots of state forests and national forest land that really isn't developed, hasn't been modified much in the last 100 years. That represents about 7,000 miles of the 13,000. So really almost half of our shoreline is in public hands. The private shoreland is a little bit more heavily used, let's say. People really get out there and modify it. We've got piers. We've got people mowing grass down to the shore, all sorts of things. Lauren might have some numbers about what sort of the statewide picture of shoreline health looks like, but it's really mixed.
Lauren, do you want to talk about that?
Sure. I think, unfortunately, we don't, you know, have a nice, neat stat to say in Wisconsin how much shoreline we've lost. I know that's something that our great neighbor next door in Minnesota has started looking to. I think they estimate in Minnesota about 50% of natural shorelines have been lost. And I'm not going to make a guess here in Wisconsin what that looks like. But like Eric said, we've definitely seen a lot of development in certain parts of the state. But I think we're also very fortunate here in Wisconsin to have, you know, protective shoreline zoning and a lot of great resources, you know, to restore those shorelines that maybe have been previously developed.
Yeah. What's this Healthy Lakes and Rivers program that you're involved with, Lauren? What are its goals?
Yeah, well, the key goals of the Healthy Lakes and Rivers program are to improve water quality and habitat using 5 key best practices. And those best practices are designed to help capture and filter runoff that's coming from the hard surfaces of on our property, right? Like roofs and driveways and decks, as you guys were just talking about.
Yeah.
And then also to help stabilize the shoreline and prevent erosion. So can talk a little bit more about those 5 practices, but those are the goals. And I would just emphasize that the program is a partnership between the DNR, Extension Lakes, our nonprofit partner, Wisconsin Lakes, and then the many like boots on the ground local partners who make this happen. So it's really kind of a technical resource program in addition to some funding assistance as well.
Yeah, well, and Extension Lakes, maybe, Eric, you could tell us more about Extension Lakes. How do you work to preserve the lakes?
Sure. So we have an office based here at UW-Stevens Point, but our footprint is statewide. We try to communicate to over 250 lake districts, which are local units of government, as well as hundreds of lake associations. Wisconsin has a long history of shoreline property owners working together, collaborating, figuring out, do we want to form a nonprofit lake association? Do we want to form a lake district, which is a taxing entity? And then how do we strategically work through our issues to protect and restore lake water quality? Our office, Extension Lakes, provides training and technical answers related to really those organizations. How do they get themselves up and running and how do they function? And we like to promote to them that this Healthy Lakes and Rivers program is sort of what we'd call a low-hanging fruit. It's a thing that they can just grab onto and say, hey, let's implement this. Let's actually do some native plantings on the shoreline. Let's get some property owners to try to put in rain gardens to infiltrate stormwater. It's all set up and ready to go. And even though there is a grant application process through the DNR, it's meant to be streamlined. It's meant to be easier for people to follow.
I went online to the Healthy Lakes site, the Healthy Lakes and Rivers Program site. It's a pretty cool site with a lot of information in it. But and we'll get to that in a bit more. But you're talking about Lake Districts. Doug in Colfax has something that relates to that. Doug, hello.
Hi, Larry. Great topic. Thank you. Chater Lake near Menominee, Wisconsin, has got quite a blue-green algae problem, and a lake district was just formed within the last couple of years. And the watershed is pretty large. It's part of the Red Cedar River. I went to a presentation about 10 years ago, and there was a presenter that explained how in the Fox River Valley some years ago, they had their greatest success cleaning up that body of water by multiple organizations working together. And I'm just wondering what your comment is on how to get that going so that we can have a bigger impact with multiple organizations that are in the same watershed.
Yeah. That's an excellent point. I'm sure both of our guests are going to have comments on it. Maybe. Well, Eric, you want to start? And then we'll go to Lauren.
Yeah, we're really fortunate over in Western Wisconsin to have another extension person who's actually based in that region. His name is Dan Zur. And Dan's been taking a real leadership role in trying to pull together the different organizations in the Red Cedar watershed. So you can actually find Red Cedar watershed-based plans. They have lots of analysis, lots of research done. And the challenge now is how do you actually implement things? How are you going to turn the knob and get things actually going? And the Lake District is just one mechanism. It's where the people down at sort of the receiving end of the watershed, the impoundment just outside of Menominee, they're agreeing that they're going to tax themselves a bit so they could fund some projects. And a Lake District can fund, for example, farmer conservation projects up in the watershed. They can match that money with county dollars, state dollars, federal dollars. Really, our approach is based on collaboration. What Lauren and I would point out is that those same shoreland owners in the Lake District, it really would be nice if they did some things on their shoreland too. You know, it maybe doesn't have the same exact impact as protecting maybe hundreds of acres up in the watershed, but it demonstrates good faith and that everyone around the lake is actually pulling in the same direction.
Yeah. Lauren, something to add there.
Sure. I think Eric brought up a lot of great points, but I'm excited by this question. I think, you know, something at the DNR, a lot of my colleagues love to see is, are people taking a watershed approach to these kind of water quality issues? And, you know, when different groups out there are preparing watershed management plans, thinking about who needs to be at the table and engaging shoreline owners as part of that process. I really think, like Eric said, that we need to kind of embrace a stewardship mentality and recognize that we're all part of a watershed, whether you're 80 miles from a lake or 10 feet from the lake. So, yeah, I love that question and that enthusiasm.
And Doug, have you worked with Dan Zur at all or spoken with Dan? Oh, we might have lost. Maybe we lost Doug. I just wondered if you had. How would Doug or anybody else, for that matter, in that region get a hold of Dan? I assume online it'd be pretty easy to.
Yeah, Dan's going to regret me saying this, but his last name is Zur, Z-E-R-R. If you just search Dan Zur and Extension online, you're going to find his contact information. All of our UW-Madison Division of Extension people all across the state, we're really there to field your questions and try and connect you with answers. So Dan has just been a really great person. He also has a radio voice. He's a musician in his free time. So give Dan a call or send him an email and find out how you can get more involved.
Well, it's really good to hear Doug talking because there's a person who's quite interested. And as I think about this, let me put it this way. How much influence do shoreland owners have over the health of the lakes and streams that they kind of live right on top of practically? Lauren, do you...
Yeah, I'm happy to take a stab at that. I think Eric might have touched on this earlier, but that really depends on the land draining to the lake or river, that the watershed that we're talking about and the size of it. So there might be some watersheds that are really large and have, you know, farmlands and a lot of urban areas draining to the lake, or we might have some smaller watersheds, for example, up north, these smaller seepage lakes, for example, that don't have as much influence coming in. So understanding your watershed definitely makes a difference, but I would argue that I can't think of a single lake or river in the state that wouldn't benefit from enhancing their shorelines with native vegetation and creating habitat. I think it all incrementally makes a big difference. And even if that, you know, it takes a while from a water quality perspective, I think people would be very surprised to see how quickly wildlife will return to an area when you start that restoration process. We do site visits and we'll come out, you know, 2-3 years later, and it will just be buzzing with pollinators and bird songs. There'll be a turtle basking on a log someplace and minnows, you know, swimming amongst the under the log. So I think it, you know, depends on how you're measuring success, right, and health.
I was going to ask how about shoreland development and what an impact it's had on animal populations, and it sounds like it has had a pretty good big impact.
Yeah, absolutely. There's been a lot of research out there that shows, you know, that as these shorelands get more developed, we lose more frogs, songbirds, the fish populations decrease, and then also even things like game fish growth rates can decline as well. And that's just kind of like the tip of the iceberg. So there's, you know, a pretty strong correlation between the health of our shorelands and the health of our wildlife. I believe they estimate that 90% of aquatic species at some time in their life, you know, rely on the shoreline buffer zone for habitat, food, or nesting, and about 70% of terrestrial or land-based species. So they are completely intertwined.
Yeah. Gary in Elko, Wisconsin, has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Gary.
Hi. Yeah, thank you for taking my call. Appreciate the show. I have some waterfront in Elko, Wisconsin, on one of the lakes, and I'm getting erosion. Want to stop the erosion. I see other neighbors have put stones and done retaining walls. I'm curious if there's regulations and suggestions for what to use. And I have close to 400 feet of frontage, so I've got a lot to cover.
Yeah.
Appreciate the help.
All right. Thanks, Gary. Where does Gary start?
I think Gary can go ahead.
Well, there's a couple of places you can start. There's lots of online resources. Up where you're at in Elko, you might want to reach out to your county land and water conservation office. They usually have staff on board to help with some technical questions. The practices that Lauren and I are talking about, these healthy lakes practices, aren't really designed to handle erosion-related issues, something where you might kind of need a little bit of engineering or someone to figure out what exactly is going on. Unfortunately, we do see maybe a lot of cases where people are putting in hard practices, stones, and other things where maybe they're actually not called for, they're not needed. And I know right here in central Wisconsin, I can find places where it's just boulder after boulder after boulder, it's just overbuilt. And that's not really helpful for riparian habitat, the types of things that Lauren was talking about. Would really like to see some way to use softer practices, native plants that have deep rooting systems that are going to hold that soil in place. But it really depends on the site. And that's kind of why your land and water conservation technicians that can come out and look at it will give you some sound advice.
So, Gary, so it's the land and water. Give us the exact spot where he should be going.
So it'd be the Langlade County, I believe, is where Elko is at. Mm-hmm. The Langlade County Land and Water Conservation Office. Kind of Google that and you'll get some names. I can't remember all the 72 counties
sure.
And who their people are, but there's a great workforce out there in our counties. They are looking to pick up these kind of projects and make sure, especially if there's active erosion, their job is to help keep soil in place. That's kind of their mission. And they're waiting for your call. It may not be right. They're probably not going to come up today, but you get on a list and you start to communicate with them. And they might even have some other tools that they can share with you. The DNR has partnered with counties actually on a number of technical guides that really help think through what might be the cause of your erosion.
But Gary might likely probably get somebody to come out and take a look from that.
Correct.
From the agency. Yeah. Gary, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Lauren Hayden, Watershed Protection Coordinator for the Wisconsin DNR Water Quality Program. Eric Olson, Director of Extension Lakes at UW Stevens Point. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're taking a look at what you can do to improve your shoreline and help out your local lake or river or stream or maybe even pond with our two guests, Lauren Hayden of the Wisconsin DNR, Eric Olson, Director of Extension Lakes at UW Stevens Point. Tom in Fitchburg has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was just calling to ask what types of shade trees you would recommend for a lakeside property in Washara County.
Okay, we've got some lakeside property in Washara County, Lauren. What are good shade trees for that situation?
I'm always particular about, you know, coming out to the property itself and seeing the native ecosystem there. So I would first say take a walk in your neighborhood and see what's out there. But I think for Washara County, you can't go wrong with some nice oaks next to the shoreline, some of our beautiful maples. I personally like a mix of both deciduous and coniferous trees. We do have within, not to plug again, Healthy Lakes and Rivers, but within our native planting guide, we do include specific tree and shrub recommendations. So I would include a mix. We want to make sure that there's, you know, habitat at all three levels. And I personally think it just looks nicer when you have, you know, maybe a red oak or dogwood right next to your, you know, red oak or something like that.
So the website, If you just type in Healthy Lakes and Rivers.
Yep. You'll find it. And then when you go to the website and you select best practices right at the top of the page, it'll lead you to our page that walks through the native plantings, rain gardens. And you'll see that for every one of the practices, there is a fact sheet that kind of does a general overview of the practice, the rough cost, what are the grant requirements, and then there's also a technical guide that goes into easy step-by-step instructions. And for the native plantings, that includes really nicely made planting plans that were developed by Patrick Goggins.
Outstanding. Tom, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Jim in Winnebago County, what's on your mind?
Afternoon, Larry. Much of the discussion so far has taken place about what one can do on land to protect the shorelines. But there's a real threat that's taking place from the water as well. You probably know that there are large boats called wake boats that are designed essentially to produce extremely large wakes. And there are a number of conservation organizations, Wisconsin's Green Fire among them, that has been working very diligently to try to make sure that those wake boats, when they are operated in the lake, are operated in a manner in which the shoreline does not completely inundated by these very large waves and that the bottom isn't turned up. The University of Minnesota just got done with a really extensive study about this and about the damage that wake boats can cause to lakes and to the shorelines. So I'd like to make people aware that there are threats to those shorelines and there are organizations that are doing everything we can to cause that to not happen. Thank you.
Jim, thanks very much for calling. Comment from, well, Eric, what about you?
Yeah, I mean, this isn't the first time we've had a water recreation challenge in Wisconsin. The reason why we have a statewide association of lakes, Wisconsin lakes, is because in the 1950s and 60s, people were starting to bring out boats that had toilets on them into the lakes. So these were houseboats. These were really large boats. And there was a lot of head scratching about, well, wait a minute. If you bring a boat with a toilet out on a lake, what's your real plan here? What are you going to do? And so there was a controversy around these boats with heads or toilets. And mm-hmm. we came up with a policy that said you can really only operate a boat with a toilet on a lake that has the services to offload that waste. You can't just take a houseboat on any lake in Wisconsin. And we've kind of come to an agreement on that. We had a problem with, I think, personal watercraft when they first came on the scene, also known as jet skis. And the state of Wisconsin said, you know what? Maybe they should operate further away from shore than other boats. You know, we came up with a policy that actually extended the distance at which you operate a jet ski, and you can't just buzz past other boats on your jet ski. So right now the debate in Wisconsin is how to handle this next one. What are we going to do about artificially enhanced wakes, and how do we, it's not just the shoreline zone and the native plants. There's a lot of issues surrounding it. So I encourage anybody who's interested in this just to start looking at some of the options and the solutions that are being discussed.
Thanks very much for that question. Appreciate your calling in today. Appreciate it very much. How much, somebody wants to know, how much money do you need to invest in order to improve a shoreline? Of course, so it depends, Lauren, on the, you know, somebody earlier caller had 400 feet. I think I had 50 feet. On Lake Monona, which is a whole different situation entirely.
Yeah, so when the program developed the grants, it was decided that they would be $1,000 per practice, and it's a cap of $25,000, you know, for any organization applying. But typically, so for the $1,000 grant, that usually covers more than enough plants for a 350-square-foot native planting or rain garden of a similar size. And I would argue would have enough money maybe for some, you know, compost and mulch, too. We have really lucky here in Wisconsin to have a lot of native plant suppliers who I think, you know, provide really reasonable prices. And the good thing with native plants, too, is you don't need to buy, you know, big gallon sizes. You can get these small plugs in a 2-inch pot, and you'll be amazed at how much they'll grow in just a few years. So again, it's a $1,000 grant, and that covers the 350 square feet. So for example, if you wanted to do two 350 square foot gardens, you can come in for two practice grants under that program.
And then, and where do people go to get the information for applying for those grants?
So they can start by, again, heading to the Healthy Lakes and Rivers webpage, just by Googling Healthy Lakes and Rivers. And then we have a grants page on there. I do want to emphasize that individual shoreline property owners cannot apply for grants. It needs to be an eligible organization that applies on their behalf. So that could be a lake association or a district, a conservation group, and a municipality. And we have a process through the DNR to determine who is eligible. But that's all, those great details are on the website. And it's a year-round application. So even if you wanted to get that started today, you could go to our website and start that grant process.
But do it through the Lakes Association, perhaps.
Exactly. Reach out and see if they might be willing to support you. And I would encourage anyone who's listening who might serve on a lake association or work for a municipality to, you know, get multiple homeowners into one grant application, just since you can have one open at a time. And obviously, we'd like to kind of see that continuity within a watershed or on an individual lake or river.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So what if I don't own land on a shoreland? Or anybody else for that matter, what can we do to improve our local lake?
Well, one thing I want to point out, so we kind of buried the lead. The DNR is willing to cost share and pay for these types of practices, a rain garden, for example. And the rain garden eligibility extends anywhere within 1,000 feet of the shoreline of a lake or 300 feet of a river. So you're in that sort of riparian area. You might be across the street. You might be a little bit down the block. Even in the city of Madison, if you're within that 1,000 feet, you can get cost share money to put in a rain garden. And that's true all across the entire state of Wisconsin. And anywhere you are in Wisconsin, you're in a watershed. So these types of kind of thinking about what kind of plants you have in the landscape and then thinking about where your storm water is headed, that should be something that everybody does. Think about putting in rain gardens and rain barrels, slow down the flow, make running water walk instead of run.
And on that note, we are out of time. I didn't get to all the questions, so we'll have to have you back to do this again, Lauren, I tell you, and Eric. Thank you both so much for being with us today, and we'll do it again. Thank you. Lauren Hayden, Watershed Protection Coordinator for the DNR and the Water Quality Program, and Eric Olson is Director of Extension Lakes at UW Stevens Point. We'll get him back, and we'll do this again with him. I think there's more that we could have discussed today. Thank you so much for listening today. This and all our shows are a team effort. Our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod. Technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. Our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. We'll talk about how to take care of your trees on Garden Talk tomorrow, and we'll look at bulb lawns as well. In the meantime, thank you for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.